And I'd now like to introduce our guest speaker for the month of October, telling his story in steps one and two, is Peter M. from Brooklyn.
Hi, everybody. I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. grateful to be alive and sober and at an AA meeting. And first things first, I'd like to thank Mike for his very kind invitation to me to be here tonight and share with you. I'd also like to congratulate Mike and this group for the message you guys are carrying and for everything that's going on in here. I'm honored to be a part of this for the next 4 weeks. God willing, I will be here every week and do my best. Very grateful to be a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. God gave me a sober date of June 23rd, 1988, and I stand here tonight as a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been set free of a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and for this I'm very, very grateful. And I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. What I have experienced is this, that if it wasn't for you guys in this fellowship and a loving and caring God, that this fellowship brought me to a program that brought me to this God, I would not be standing here tonight, but I got a pretty good idea where I would be. And that would probably be in jail, in another institution, or living the life of a hopeless drunk, living from hallway to hallway, because that's where I left off in 1988. So I stand here tonight free, a man with just a little bit of dignity and some self-respect because of what you have given me here a day at a time. My home group is the Free Spirit Group, located in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And if anyone has not visited this place yet, you will know the only requirement for membership there are pinky rings, sunglasses, and gold jewelry. At my home group, we change how it works into how you're doing. We have guys there who actually think The Godfather was an educational movie. And I will always share this story about the type of people God put in my life when I first showed up at Free Spirit. I was a new guy on the block, and they decided to go fishing. And I'd never been fishing before, but they were going to go fishing. And so how do five guys from Bensonhurst, Brooklyn get dressed to go fishing like I am tonight? And I mean, they were on a boat 2 minutes and saying, "Hey, you get my shoes wet. What are you doing?" These are the type of guys, if you yelled out, "Land ho," they would say, "Don't talk about my mother like that." Anyway, we were out fishing for a few minutes, and there was a friend of mine, Sally Boy, doesn't come around anymore, but at the time he was out on a boat, and he had the reel in the water, and we're waiting for someone to catch something, and he finally caught something, and he's trying to pull this thing up on board, and he's pulling, and he's pulling, and he's pulling. He finally gets this fish on board, but before he brings it on board, he couldn't get it on, so we're thinking maybe it's someone from the neighborhood we thought was on a long vacation, and he finally gets this fish on board, and it's flipping and flapping all over the deck. So what do? We start throwing punches at it and kicks at it to try to calm it down. I start crying because of the poor fish. They want to throw me overboard. Anyway, Sally Boy grabs this little fish in a hug and sticks his head underwater. And I say, "Sally, what are you doing?" He says, "I'm going to drown him." So, these were the spiritual leaders God put in my life. But those are some of the people I needed to be around when I first got here. And sadly, not many of them are still with us. Either they stopped coming to meetings or they're drinking. So I feel blessed that I came here in 1988 after many, many attempts and have remained here, stood here, and have kind of packed into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been able to pass on a message. As a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I automatically assume a responsibility to uphold the traditions as well as the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, not only to be an awakened member here, but to be an informed member, to study our traditions, to study our history, not just to know more, so I can do sound bites at a meeting, but to understand more, because when I understand what it is I belong to, I become a better member. I got in here in 1988 of June. There's a whole humble legacy that preceded my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to know about that. I need to be in touch with that. I also need to pass that on to people who are walking in this door. because when I walk in here in 1988, I was full of self. I was full of a lot of other things like anger, guilt, and remorse, but I was also full of self. And I just figured my entrance out into Alcoholics Anonymous is what started AA. But there was, you know, a talk between two gentlemen in a kitchen that has widened over the years to where we are here tonight. And then Bill shows up at Dr. Bob's, meets Dr. Bob, and we're here tonight. There's a whole lot of history that went on before I got here in 1988. As a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, my job here is to serve Alcoholics Anonymous to the best that God allows me. I'm no longer the most important person at any meeting. That went away a long time ago. So if I'm standing here or sitting here after 14 years and been given this wonderful message and being around this sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous and I still think it's all about me, I probably missed something. It is not all about me. It's about me being here to give back. I came to receive and I stay to give. And passing this message on is truly, and I don't give this lip service, is one of the many, many bright spots in my life that God has given me since I got here. I've seen others recover because of this message, and all I did was pass it on. I've seen loneliness vanish in them and me as I passed this message on. I've seen a fellowship grow up around those new people and myself as I passed this message on. And I'm very grateful to a loving and caring God that has given me something that you gave me to transmit, a message of hope. See, a vision for you tells us we can transmit something we haven't got, but I need to make sure my house is in order. Because I've seen many people lead the blind right into a ditch. You get the non-alcoholic and Alcoholics Anonymous sponsoring the real alcoholic who needs to recover on a spiritual basis or else. And he tells that real alcoholic, just put the plug in a jug, don't drink and go to meetings. And that guy dies and we tell him, well, he didn't want it enough. That real alcoholic, if he was like me, took the plug out of the jug and didn't want to make meetings and wanted to drink, would come here and leave. There were times in my attempts to get sober, I would go to meetings and they would tell me, keep coming back. And I would hear them share and they were sober and I would say, AA don't work for me. I keep going back and I keep getting drunk. Meeting makers don't always make it. I was told, meeting makers make it. I said, I'm not making it. Now what do I do? I got rehabs behind me. I got jail behind me. I'm looking at the street right in my face to live in the street. What do I do? What do I do? When I got here in 1988, thank the good Lord, after spending some time in a treatment center in Long Island, I was sent to Minnesota. And I look over the series of circumstances that took place in getting me to Minnesota. I swear, I think God just picked me up and put me in Minnesota because I was put in people's lives and they were put in my path. I never, ever could pick friends. They were just as bad as me or worse. The people I met in Alcoholics Anonymous have been teachers, and the people I met in Minnesota were giants in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember them telling me, you're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual life would conquer, a spiritual way of living would conquer. I tried every other way, and they gave me the real deal. And these were the people God put in my life, and I'm very, very grateful for that. To tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what I'm trying to be like today, and cover our first and second step while I do this. My first drink came when I was about 14 years old, and my life has never been the same from my first drunk to where I stand tonight. Not only my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous, my life has never been the same ever. My first drink, I grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and it was over by St. Dominic's Church. I was about 14 years old at the time. And St. Dominic's Church was located on 75th Street and 20th Avenue. And they were having this feast on this Saturday night. My friends were drinking beer just off the corner. They were passing around a quart of Colt 45 beer. And I watched them pass around the quart. And I was just off maybe 20 feet from them. And I watched them pass around the quart. And they seemed to be in the moment, experiencing life. They were joyous, happy, and free drinking Colt 45 beer. And I wanted desperately, like I did up until that time at 14 on my first drunk, always wanted to pack into the mainstream. And I had this thing going on inside my gut that just wouldn't allow me. And if I did, it was a hit and miss and get out of there. Hit and run and get out of there. Because the voices in my mind were telling me, get out, you don't belong. I had this judge screaming at me. You ever walk into a mall and you hear the chatter of all the voices? You get back in your car. They were still going on in my mind when I was growing up. That type of static was going on. And none of it was good. None of it was good. And this Saturday night was certainly no different. This was spring, summertime, and I had lost my mom January 23rd of that same year. And I was completely leveled by it. I always share this, that I believe in my heart that she ought to be in here with us celebrating life like we do, a day at a time, and experience this freedom that we're given. But she didn't. She experienced what More About Alcoholism talks about in our big book, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization over and over and over again. And I didn't know anything about that until I experienced it in a hotel room when I tried to take my life, because the pain of living an alcoholic life was horrific. But that's what she experienced, and she finally took her life, and I was completely leveled by it. Been homeless and panhandled and been arrested and all the horrors of alcoholism. I bought that. I wasn't asking for this. And when she died, I was completely leveled. This Saturday night, I remember watching my friends drink and wanting desperately to get in there. My dad had told me many times not to be hanging out with the bums on the corner. I was going to become a product of my environment, and don't bring any of those girls by this house. Up until I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, if my dad walked in the room, I'd go out the back door because I saw him and I would shake in my shoes. I was just so afraid of this man. Because of what I've been given here and what you guys have awakened me with, my dad and I have this really neat relationship today. Thank the good Lord for that. But back then it was a lot different. And his warnings of me going to the corner and hanging out had me shaking in my shoes. But I don't know why, till this very moment, my friends were passing around the court and I put my hand in there and I took a few pops. And the beer went down and nothing happened. My dad didn't drive up. I was fearful of the cops driving up and locking me up. They didn't show up. Everything was okay. And so on that, I took a few more pops. Excuse me. I drank a little bit more, and I drank a little bit more, and then I experienced what our doctor's opinion talks about, a sense of ease and comfort by taking a few drinks, drinks I saw others taking with impunity. For the first time in my life, as the beer rose to my head, and my nerves kind of settled down, and my stomach stopped rocking and rolling, and the voices kind of went away, I start to feel really good. I experienced ease and comfort for the first time in my life. I experienced ease and comfort for the first time in my life, and the loss of my mom was removed. It was one of the first things to go. This pain that was walking with me was taken away, and I was starting to feel good. The fear of my dad was taken away. The cops taken away. All this fear was taken away. I was in the moment. I was experiencing life as it was happening. As I continued to drink, I got taller. I got some beer muscles. I think I found hair on my chest that night and a few tattoos. And every girl in the corner wanted the worst way to get with me, too. I mean, this was... beer was working. It was the panacea for my ills, if you will. Everything that plagued me up until I got to that place out there that was indescribably wonderful was pushed out of the side. Bill says in his story, I had arrived, and when I was drinking cold 45 beer across the street from St. Dominic's Church, I arrived. This was my passage into manhood. Now, I've heard many of us experience some of the consequences on the first drunk. I've heard some horrific stories, people drinking on the first, getting the first drunk and terrible things happening. You know, beating up the wife, getting into car crashes, getting arrested, you name it. None of that stuff happened to me. I remember I went home, I got up the next morning, I went to bed, I remember what took place that night, I got up the next morning, I remembered what took place the day before, I went into this park called Seth Lowe Park to play Sunday morning basketball, and on my way into that park there was a little different thing going on inside of me. I was starting to feel really good about me, and my shoulders were a little bit wider, and I had a little bit of a swag, and I walked into that park like I was one of the older guys. I found my solution. It was called beer. This was what was going to work for me. All my problems were going to be solved next time I drink beer. And I knew that. See, I had no idea. I just stepped onto a road paved right to hell called alcoholism. I didn't know what makes me an alcoholic. I knew nothing about a threefold illness. I knew nothing about this mental obsession to alcohol. I was going to experience it. I already lit the fuse. It was just a matter of when it caught me. But I knew nothing about this stuff. I knew nothing about this mental illness that was going to tell me to drink regardless of the consequences the day before. Down the road, I would get in terrible trouble on a Monday. And Tuesday, my mind would tell me Monday wasn't that bad. It would lie to me. It would lie to me over and over and over again. And the truth always caught up to me and at the end almost killed me. Whenever I took alcohol into my body, the craving was always intensified, never satisfied. A doctor's opinion talks about this phenomenon of craving that never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never. In me, it does. That's what separates me. My book uses words like alcoholics of our type, the real alcoholic, people who are in that class. They separate us from the hard drinker, the moderate drinker. it's really important that when we come in here, we know what we are too, what our truth is. I've seen people come in here who are addicted to other things, have no problems with alcohol, can take or leave it alone, and they keep relapsing, and no one sends them to where maybe they need to get the right help. And I found my truth when I got here in 1988 by years of suffering alcoholism, the allergy, the obsession, and the spiritual malady they talk about. I knew nothing about that stuff my first drunk. I just knew I drank, I felt good, I'll take more. Because I want to get to that place out there and capture that elusive feeling once more. The following Saturday rolled around and I got fired up again. It was just a little bit different, but I knew I wanted to go continue to drink. And I was drinking on Saturday nights, and then it became Friday and Saturday, and then it became Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And what I started to experience were consequences as a direct result of my drinking. My life was starting to get unmanageable. It was starting to unravel is what was happening. And everyone else saw it before I did. But before the truth showed up to me and I was able to see it and grasp it, there was a whole lot of hell to pay. Consequences at the beginning would be like my dad telling me to be home at a certain time and I would blow that right off. And I'd walk in when I want. And I'd get the riot act. I would leave my house sober and come home in a completely different condition. Oftentimes when I was drunk, I was a nasty, ugly, drunk, dumping lots of earthy, ugly language on my two kid brothers who were home. My dad would be out dating or hanging out with his friends. And I'd walk in and my two kid brothers would be watching TV or playing games and I'd walk in. And I would dump all of this stuff, all this venom I had inside of me because God took my mom. God left me with this guy I called dad. I have no clue who he is. And I wasn't feeling too good about me, so I dumped on my two kid brothers. And what started to happen was this. My alcoholism was directly affecting them, and they didn't do anything. They were little by slowly becoming afraid of me. They had idolized me up until that point. Now they were becoming afraid of me. They didn't know what was going to walk in the door. See, our big book says we're like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. I destroyed everything in my path, and it wasn't because I was that powerful, but this thing we call alcoholism is. So for me to stand here tonight and tell you, just don't drink and go to meetings and you're a winner, I'm lying to you. That's a lie. In fact, I may even kill you with that statement. Because I need to pay back. I need to give back here and give back to the people I robbed. Emotionally, spiritually, and in a material way. So my brothers were starting to become really afraid of me, and what they would do is tell my dad. And my dad would get me the next day. And in the Italian family, it's not like Leave It to Beaver where we have these, you know, talks in the library. My dad's a longshoreman, a street guy from South Brooklyn, and a tough guy. And so he would corner me in a part of the house and, you know, read me the riot act about what I was doing with my life, that I was going to become a product of my environment. Your brothers are becoming afraid of you. And it would go on and on. And basically, my biggest problem with my drinking back then was their problem with my drinking. And I had this thing in my gut that was saying, you don't know what it's like for me. Whether it was tough for me or not, I had no right to inflict pain on them. But what I found out in years, I had no choice. Even if I knew what was waiting for me down the road, I couldn't stop anyway. My life was going to turn right into hell very shortly. I remember I start to experience some more consequences as a direct result of my drinking. What alcoholism turned me into was a coward, quickly. Not a hero, not a tough guy, a coward. And like most cowards, what I did was harm people who loved me the most and would run for cover. You know, I would steal money and help you look for it. I was that type of person. I would take things that didn't belong to me. What I started to do was steal from my dad. And what he would do is go down for breakfast in the morning, and I listened for him, and I go into his bedroom, and he had usually his pants draped over the dresser, and I go into his pocket and take some money out. My dad always carried a lot of cash on him. And I would take a 20 or a couple of 20s. And then I meet him for breakfast, and he'd ask me if I had enough money on me for the day, like any parent would. I would tell him, no, I can use a few bucks, and he'd go back upstairs and come down and give me some money. And I had no problem with this. I started to take money from my kid brothers when they weren't looking. If there was, you know, 50 bucks in a drawer, 30's half, and it was going with me. And that's how I went about my life. I started to take jewelry that didn't belong to me, and I was still young, but yet I was experiencing what Bill talks about in his story. When the morning terror madness were on him, it was starting to become turning on me. Bill talks about how the drinking turned his fight like a boomerang and cut him to ribbons. I was already experiencing this, and I was just out of the starting gate. I was experiencing my first few drunks, and already as I was experiencing this type of unmanageability. One morning I woke up and everyone was asleep in my house, and I had that panic. Now what am I going to do? I need money to go get fired up. And so what I did was, as I'm going through the drawers, I discovered my dad's checkbook. And so I got the brainstorm, if I would just forge his name on one of the checks, I would go down to a liquor store, to a bodega, and cash, and I can get fired up like that. And that's what I did for a very short time. I didn't know anything about checking statements. That stuff came back to him, and he came looking for me. He caught me over in Manhattan, downtown Manhattan, right by the Brooklyn Bridge, across the street from the place called the Southbridge Towers. And I was sitting in the car with this girl, and he drove up, and he jumped out of the car, and he screamed my name, and I knew I was in serious trouble. I was looking for a boat to China. And I got out of the car. Instead of driving away, I started running away, and he caught me. And what I did was, like a coward, I started to come up with these fake tears. And I blamed the girl in the car and the guys in the neighborhood. I was hanging out in the Lower East Side now. And he didn't buy any of it. And what happened to me was they sent me to my first rehab. And what I did in rehab was this. 28 days, I did push-ups and sit-ups. I learned these words that I always talk about. I learned words like enablers and dysfunctional family and inner child. Dysfunctional family, I'm here tonight. My family's home. Who's dysfunctional? You know? I don't know about this thing that, you know, and first of all, how could I stand at a podium and tell you my family's dysfunctional when they're not even here to defend themselves? You know, enablers, my dad would give me money and deny me money, throw me out and take me back in, whatever it took, maybe to see, let me see a truth. They were doing the very best they could with what they had. The only way to express love was by what they were doing. I don't believe in enablers. That's therapeutic stuff. That stuff may get me drunk and kill me. And I have nothing, I don't know anything about this word called inner child. I don't even go there. I don't know what that means. But I was getting sick, and after 28 days, I looked like I spent 6 months in Bally's Jack O'Lane, and I was lifting weights and just eating and not thinking I had a problem. Speakers would come in and bring AA meetings into the rehab, and you know, I would write on the chalkboard. Miami Vice was a hot show at the time, and my higher power was Don Johnson. I wanted to be like Don Johnson. And I would write on this chalkboard, Miami Vice, 9 o'clock, speakers leave promptly. That's how dedicated I was to this. And they would come in, and I would wait for them to leave, and 28 days later, I got out. And I had a girlfriend meet me at the door, and we cracked open a bottle of blackberry brandy, and I went right back to that same vicious cycle again. Right back. And I was doing the same things I did before I got into rehab. I was experiencing unmanageability. I was experiencing the phenomenon of craving. I was experiencing this mental obsession to alcohol that told me to drink regardless. I remember I went to live with my grandparents at one time, and my grandmother had to throw me out because I was bringing my alcoholism into her house. I got a job as a longshoreman over on the Brooklyn waterfront, and I brought my alcoholism down there. Wherever I went, I showed up with my illness. And I made my second rehab, and I made my third rehab. And I remember I was dating this girl, and we were living in this motel above a nightclub in Staten Island. And one of these nightclubs that are under new management every week. And so it was one of these motels, and there I am, and I'm basically praying to die every day in this place. And I was drinking Jack Daniels at the time, and she was a barmaid downstairs, and she would come up like maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning with the money she made for the night, and I'd steal it and go about my business. Every so often she'd come around the back and come up the steps into the room, and I was lying in bed, and she would bring me on a tray my Jack Daniels with a little bit of water. And I prayed to die back then. And I remember experiencing something that I never thought I would experience, that incomprehensible demoralization, that my illness wants me dead, will settle for me drunk, and it was doing a really good job of it. I came across a bottle of pills I took out of her purse, what was left of a bottle of pills. They were Valium. And what I did with them, I swallowed them, and I washed it down with Jack Daniels, and I waited to die. Because the courage to do battle, as Bill says in his story, was not there. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match here. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master, and I wanted to die. And I remember taking those pills and washing it down, and I just wanted to die. Just take me out of this. I cannot live this way anymore. And I remember thinking, this is what my mom experienced. This is what she experienced, the torment she experienced. This is exactly what alcoholism loves to do. By the grace of God, that didn't take. And I remember a guy knocking on the door in this hotel, and he had heard some of my stuff going on, and he told me about some meetings that were taking place in a hospital. He sat down and started to tell me his story. And I was saying, well, I'll be really patient with the guy and listen to him, because when he gets done, I'm going to hit him up for $20 and get out of here. It was the hand of AA stretching out once more to help me. Many, many times, the flimsy reed that came across, I didn't know, turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. Many, many times people showed up. God showed up with these people to try to help me. And it wasn't until 1988 that I finally held on. I remember going into my fifth rehab, and I had gotten bounced off the waterfront, and I was experiencing an awful lot of torment. And I went into this rehab for 9 weeks, and I was physically separated from alcohol for 9 weeks. I got out on a Saturday, and I was drunk on a Monday. I was physically separated, and I was drunk in 2 days, because the main problem with alcohol centers in the mind, not in the body, and my mind was still telling me, we can go drink. What I found out in here is this. If the main problem, the alcoholic center, is in the mind, where's the solution? So I would raise my hand and say, the mind. And it wasn't. It was in this, the awakening of the spirit. Because when my spirit was awakened, I was given a new mind. And if my mind's not telling me to drink, I'm no longer suffering from the compulsion. Lots of times I hear people, newcomers, saying, hey, I have a compulsion to drink. No, you don't. What you have is obsession of the mind because you're untreated. So me, who've been here a little while and been given this information, my job is to give them the information if they care to have it. I'm very grateful when I showed up here begging for a drink, I was looking for someone with the solution who was armed with the facts. Very grateful for that. I went right back to the same vicious cycle again. I hit my sixth rehab, and I spent about a day and a half in my sixth rehab. And I signed myself out because I could not take being in this place. I had to go drink once again. I got addicted to some other things along the way, which at the end I walked away from, but I can never, ever walk away from alcohol. I had many, many powerful desires to stop drinking. Page 24 in our book talks about this. Many powerful desires. I'm never going to do this again. I'm destroying my family. I knew it. I knew what I was turning into. I had a moment of clarity, if you will, by the Port Authority over in Manhattan on the 9th Avenue side one day, where the truth showed up to me. God in His infinite mercy gave me my truth on a platter. Says, this is what you are. And I thought of my mom passing, my family who I hadn't seen for quite some time. My entire life passed before me, and I knew I was going to die as a drunk. And what I did with that moment of clarity was curse God. And I went about my usual routine again, drinking and dying. I would have many, many times where I said, this has to stop. I cannot do it anymore. I need to stop. Powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. I lost the power of choice whether I was going to drink or not, which meant I needed to find a spiritual base of life or else. And I was experiencing all else, or else, for many, many years. I was dying. My mind was still delusional. It was still telling me, if there's a crack in a wall, we can get through. We'll do it a little different. Just a little bit different. I'll hang out on this corner, not on that corner. I'll switch. I won't drink Bacardi anymore. I'll go back to Jack Daniels. I won't drink beer with Jack Daniels. I mean, you name it, I came up with it. I'll mix other stuff with it. I was like a pharmacist at one point. The end result was, no matter how many times I tried to stop or control or regulate my drinking, I got drunk. And the allergy took over. I went about my life a little bit longer after that moment of clarity on the by the Port Authority. And truly by God's grace, I hit my seventh and, God willing, last rehab. And that was through a series of circumstances where God intervened once again in my life. My life that was basically worth nothing, God thought it was worth saving. And I remember I got thrown out of this apartment I was living in. I was homeless and living on the streets. I remember the first night I was homeless. I thought it would be a blast to watch these people just run through the streets all night. Nowhere to go, not worried about anything. The first night I was homeless, I'll never forget the feeling I had. I was scared to death. Because the first time in my life, I said to myself, no one knows where I'm at. I don't have to report to anybody. And if I die or get arrested, no one's going to know. It was a very frightening feeling. There was no net. And I was scared to death. And I said, the only way I'm going to get out of this is I'm going to die. and let's make it quick. And that was my conscious contact with God back then. God, take me now, because I can't live like this anymore. I was suffering at the hands of alcoholism, and it was loving every minute of it. People who I adore, like my family, I pushed them out of my life. People that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous in my futile attempts to get sober, I pushed them out of my life. I went to the Free Spirit Group one time years ago and stood at the back of the room and had contempt for everyone in here. And the people who talked about a God, a loving God, that had kind of transformed their life to where they stood that night, I hated them even more. And so much I wanted to be just like them. You know, I remember getting this apartment that I was living in, and right before I got thrown out. But I remember coming home after 2 day drunks, and Sunday was always by far my worst day out there. And I would see people on the street, you know, with their Sunday paper, walking their dog, and having their bagels, you know, to go home and have breakfast. If I was home, I would come to maybe 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Sometimes my landlord would be out in the backyard with his family having those family barbecues in the summer. I hated all of that stuff. There was such a part of me that wanted to be like them. When I got sober and I got my first apartment, I'll never forget this. I was living in this apartment, and it was Sunday morning, and I got this great idea. I went down to the bagel store and I bought the Sunday paper. I lived alone. I bought a dozen bagels. And I remember walking out of this store and looking up to the heavens and saying, thank you, God, I'm finally legitimate. There was some great joy in that for me. I remember hitting my seventh and last, God willing, last rehab. And I was in there after leaving the streets and living the life I was. And after about 10 days, the insidious insanity that Bill talks about of the first drink was galloping back to me. The main problem with alcohol sin is in the mind, and I lack power. And I was experiencing it firsthand. See, I was not yet awakened, and here I was in rehab for 10 days, and more than anything else, I wanted to go pick up a drink and get out of this rehab and have a drink and settle my stomach, and the voices would stop again, and I'd be back. And then I can go to rehab and talk about my dysfunctional family and my enablers and my inner child. That didn't happen. They sent me off to Minnesota. And while I was in Minnesota, I met some wonderful people out there that talked about a God of their understanding, this wonderful fellowship, the program in this fellowship. They told me that I had to be living in all three sides of the triangle in order to be awakened, in order to recover. It was a lot more than just showing up at meetings. I've heard many times, just don't drink and go to meetings. Step one tells me I'm powerless over alcohol, which means I don't have power, I don't have choice, I don't have control, and a blind man can see my life was unmanageable. So when I was told, just don't drink and go to meetings, if I'm powerless, how can I pull that off? I can't. And then we say, well, he doesn't want it enough, or she don't want it enough. If I had the power just to not drink, why would I come here? I'd stay home and not drink. The first time alcohol bit me, I would say, too hot, I'm leaving it alone. But I went back over and over and over again. Where alcohol was involved, my big book tells me I've been strangely insane. The almost certain consequences that come from even taking a glass of beer don't crowd into my mind to stop me, to deter me. All I can think of was, it won't be that bad. It'll be a little bit different this time. The lie, always, over and over and over again. I would buy the lie. See, so many times I've heard an Alcoholics Anonymous think the drink through. That may kill some people. Because if you're beyond the power of choice, power and control, how could you think it through? What good is that going to do? My mind is sick. It's not going to take me all the time to the end. It's going to go halfway and say, not too bad. And we'll pick up a drink. And you know what happens once we pick up a drink? The allergy kicks in. This doesn't cover social drinkers or the hard drinkers. See, our big book talks about the hard drinker, where change of environment, ill health, falling in love, wanting of a doctor, he may stop or moderate. I've been in love. I've been out of love. I changed my environment. I have warnings of a doctor. I have horrific things happen to me, and I kept going to pick up a drink again, thinking it'll be a little different this time. Powerless over alcohol. What does that mean? Lack of power is my dilemma. I needed more than showing up at this fellowship, and certainly I need to be around this fellowship. It's one part of our triangle, but I need to do some other things. I got out of, I was living in Minnesota, and after about 10 months of living out there, I was brought home, and I was actually brought to the Free Spirit Group. And I was making some other meetings for some other things I was suffering from, and I found out what my truth was, again, that I'm a real alcoholic. I did some other substances, but like I said a moment ago, I walked away from most of that stuff. I could not walk away from alcohol. People told me that if I need to talk about other substances at an AA meeting, don't you think you're at the wrong meeting? And so I would attend these other places just to hear if there was any identification. And I met my appointed teacher at the Free Spirit Group. I was brought to the Free Spirit Group, and I remember praying, Father, if you're out there, please show me a teacher. The same God I had prayed to save my life in a hallway one day. Just please save me from this torment I'm living in. I went back to that same God, and I said, just show a teacher for me. Put a teacher in my life, because I don't know what to do. They're talking about this thing called sponsorship. I'm afraid to pick anyone. I mean, I remember a guy walking into my group, and he had all the big books. He was the literature person. I didn't know a literature person. I just thought he was the head of AA because he walked in with all the books. You know, I would see someone, you know, be the chairperson of the meeting. I said, they must be important. Maybe I'll ask him. You know, things like that. And that voice would just tell me, wait, be patient. I'm sitting in Free Spirit one night, and an anniversary is happening, and this gentleman got up there and shared his experience, strength, and hope. And it was very similar to the message that I was attracted to in Minnesota. And he talked about the fellowship of loving God and the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which awakened his spirit, completely transformed his life. And that same quiet voice says, go see that man. And my appointed teacher was put in my life. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he gave me some things to do first. Before I sponsor you, you need to do something first, and that's to read the first portion of his big book. And on the second visit, when I was done, he asked me if I was ready to tell my story and go through with these 12 proposals, and he told me what I was in for. Because one of the questions he asked me was I willing to go to any lengths to recover? And he kind of hinted on and gave me a general idea of what any lengths may look like. Some of the any lengths I agreed to, if I knew what they were when I agreed to them, I don't know if I would agree to them. But we began this journey. Now, I was told many times, read chapter 5, read acceptance, work the slogans. Slogans are great things, but they told me they use this expression, the banisters to the steps. So basically, if you have no steps, banisters are useless, aren't they? It would be like being stuck in a desert and praying for transportation. Someone shows up with a boat. I mean, what do I do? So my sponsor, I'm very grateful for, started from the cover of his big book, and he pointed out a couple of things right on the cover, which says textbook, and he explained to me what textbook meant, that this wasn't a novel, that I had to have an experience with this book. If I had an experience with this book, I was going to have an experience with my God, of my understanding. He flipped over on a little flap here, it says, and it's not in the fourth edition, but I understand that it's going to try to fix that. The third edition says, but the basic text pages 1 to 164 have remained unchanged. This is the AA message. That is the message, and that's what I had to recover from, and that's what he gave me, passed on. And we went through some of the early pages of our big book that talked about some history, and then we came across a chapter I never knew existed. It was called Doctor's Opinion, which talked about me. It talked about this psychic change I needed to recover with. It talked about this phenomenon of craving. It talked about the mental obsession. And very clear language. And I identified as I read this book, and he pointed out certain passages in my big book to me. And I realized what separates me from my kid brothers who can drink, get drunk sometimes, but show up for life and their life's not unmanageable. But I get drunk with them and I disappear. I have no clue what's going to happen to me. That's the scary part. I don't even know what happens to me when I drink. Powerless over alcohol, I don't even know when I'm going to drink. Many times, like I said earlier, powerful desire, I'm not drinking, I'm not doing this, and as Bill said, banging on a bar wondering how this got started. The strange mental blank spots. I'll throw this out too about strange mental blank spots. How many of us in here have had strange mental blank spots in Alcoholics Anonymous, in other behaviors, untreated alcoholism? How many of that stuff has brought about that fierce resentment, that financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives, blameless children, because of our behavior in Alcoholics Anonymous sober? Strange mental blank spot. I know I experienced it in different areas of my life. I'm not doing this anymore because it causes too much pain. And then I'm in it saying, but wait a minute. I said, I'm not going to do this. Lack of power is my dilemma. Because I put down a drink does not mean I am well. In fact, I may be worse. Because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months. And December 22nd, 1988, I wanted to pick up a drink just as much as I wanted to stay sober. My behavior on some days was atrocious. I was acting out, behaving, cursing, acting like a drunk without a drink in me, making Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I thought I was through forever. I was headed right back to a drink. Alcoholism loved every minute of it. It was setting up every opportunity for me to get drunk, and I was biting every time, taking a little nibble. The end result was a drinking bottle with my name on it. That's what this does. Lack of power, one of the most powerful lines in our big book, lack of power is my dilemma. So powerless over alcohol, powerless over a lot of other things. Page 51 of my book, big book says, leaving the drink question aside, let's push that aside for a minute. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. And then we flip over the page to page 52. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've experienced some of that stuff. Trouble with personal relationships, not only while I'm drunk and here, without being awakened. That stuff will take me back to a drink, full of fear, couldn't make a living. Couldn't be of real help to other people. Have I experienced any of that stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous? Those are yes or no answers, and the question is why? When I have all of this information? You know, if you're new or you're around here a while and we're experiencing that white knuckle sobriety, my question to you is why? Because I was asked the same question. Making meetings in Minnesota, December 22nd, 1988, sober almost 6 months to the day, I remember showing up at this gentleman's house and sharing my dramas of life with him. I was completely miserable. The torment of living without my old solution, even though it was going to kill me, was terrible. I lacked power. And I showed up at this guy's doorstep and I shared, unloaded my dramas of life. And he said to me, where are you with God in the 12 steps? The steps, when do you start, was my reply. He says, when you stop throwing up, you're late. And I heard him. I never forget that answer he gave me. He disturbed me on the question of alcoholism. He got me angry. But he was speaking the truth to me. The first three steps I hear, do the AA waltz. I don't know where this got started from. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, die. Get drunk. A step a year. Could you imagine, I heard somebody was here not too long ago say, if Bill had to take a step a year, would I be standing here tonight? Would Bob be sober? God forbid. But that's some of the information that goes on out there. Separated from alcohol, Ebby showed up at Bill's house. Bill was drinking. And Ebby passed a message on to him. Bill was drinking. Oh, I can't touch him. He's drunk. I got to stay away from him. Going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, someone shows up wet. Oh, my God, he's drunk. And where else is he going to go? To the bar and say, I want to drink. What are you drinking? But we do something here that's indescribably wonderful. What we do here. And I see it all the time. I've seen it with my eyes. My own eyes, I've seen it. How people come in here with nothing, dying, broken. And they're resurrected because of the message that's given in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great responsibility here. We all do. What goes on in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, this sacred place? What takes place? People are brought back to life. I've seen it. I've experienced it in my own life. My sponsor started taking me through a doctor's opinion, and I was introduced to Bill's story. And he gave me, what he did for me was talk a little bit about Bill Wilson. I mean, I knew a little bit about Bill, but he talked about Bill Wilson and the miraculous things that happened to him in Towns Hospital. And the miraculous things that happened to him while he was sober, helping others, how that message was made very clear to him. And I saw the first half of Bill's story that I totally identify with, and the second half of Bill's story on his recovery. And I was brought to the chapter, There's a Solution. And he showed me a great promise on page 25, the great fact. The great fact that my attitude towards life, towards others and God's universe was going to be completely transformed. And I thought about it. That's what I've been having problems with my entire life. And then he showed me where this stuff was going to materialize in our nine-step promises. It showed up in 25 and it materializes in our nine-step promises. And then he pointed me to page 52, which was just the opposite. That if I didn't do this, this was what was waiting for me. Great stuff. Great information. I was brought through more about alcoholism. One of the things that was pointed out to me was this. More about alcoholism. If you didn't get it yet, we're going to talk more about it. And I found that 23 to 43 was talking about my mind because that's what I knew with a spiritual awakening. See, the idea that I'm like other people or presently maybe, that means drunk or sober, that idea had to be smashed. Well, what are they talking about? Well, I knew I was different from other people when I was drinking, but I'm making meetings, I'm sober. I'm still not like other people. I need to live on a spiritual basis of life or experience or else. I know people who nurse grudges. I know people who can live like that. How, I don't know. That stuff to me will kill me. and I'm powerless over alcohol, and take me right back to a drink. When I got done with more about alcoholism and experience and some more information experiences with this first step, you know, thank the good Lord, our solution is step two. For me, the solution to this whole thing is step two. I was brought to the edge of a cliff at step one. You're telling me I'm deaf. Step one tells me I am drinking. I'm in alcoholics. You tell me I'm still going to drink? Yeah. And I'm brought to the edge of a cliff with step one. And step two, thank the good Lord, is my solution. Oh, here's what I have to do. And I was going to get to this place, came to believe I was going to arrive at this place where this power greater than myself was going to restore me to sanity, wholeness of mind. If I'm being restored to sanity, it must mean I'm insane. Why would I have to be restored to sanity? You see that? And the insanity for me was not what happened to me once I was fired up. It's what preceded the drink. What was going on in my mind? 9 weeks in a rehab, out on a Saturday, Monday I'm drunk again. What was my mind telling me? Getting arrested, being homeless, my mind would take me back to a drink. That was the insanity that I was experiencing. What I was showing going through the work this last time was what kind of insanity am I experiencing currently in my life? Where is my life unmanageable? Where am I experiencing current agnosticism? Because if I am, I'm in self and I'm in fear. I have to be unmanageable. And I saw some of that stuff. But this is the first time around. That's what I saw with the drink. God, you know, in chapter 10, says, I wish I can believe as that man believes. You know, some people I saw walking around like they were actually touched by the Spirit. And I said, I can never pull that off. How do they get to that place of this awakening? How do they get to be so enlightened? And my book tells me my own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. Was I willing or not? Well, based on my first step horror show, I was certainly willing. And that's all I needed. An experience, this awakening they talk about in step 12, begins with a spirit of willingness. Just a spirit of willingness, and I'm on my way. My big book promises me that. I was taking a guy through the work. I had big problems with God. And I showed him how his own conception, group of drunks, good orderly direction, G-O-D, was sufficient. Are you willing, yes or no? And when I pointed this out to him, I showed him in chapter 10 Gnostic where it says, God does not make too hard terms to those who earnestly seek him. That's why I live life on God's terms today. It's easy, simple. It's inclusive, not exclusive. And I showed this guy this. And he started to cry right in front of me because he didn't think he had a shot at Alcoholics Anonymous because of the God thing. And I showed him that. He never heard group of junks, good early direction. He didn't know he can choose his own conception. He didn't know that whatever he had, even if it was inadequate compared to someone else, was sufficient. This is great information. Chapter 2 Agnostics, for me, blew the doors open for me on this. It just made this wide opening. Welcome. Am I willing or not? See, our steps, oftentimes we tell people, go back to the step prior. You know, you're in your fourth step and you're showing, go back to the third step. Lie. When we show up here on the horror show and we're willing to go to any lengths in step one, what changed? What changed? And for me, my experience with getting a first step and learning about it in here and combining experience and knowledge, that was enough to move me through this. That was enough to move me through this. Thank God. So I hit step two and I saw that this power was going to restore me to sanity. That this was my solution to the whole thing. Well, how do I get there? I was certainly willing based on my first step. I was willing to take direction from a group of drunks with good orderly direction. I found power in the unity of this fellowship. Really interesting. My dad used to try to teach me lots of lessons when I was a kid. And I remember one thing he always told me. In unity, there's power. You're always alone. You're going to get crushed out there. In unity, there's power. And my dad was always surrounded by a bunch of guys. And they looked powerful. They were powerful. They demanded respect. They went through life like with wide shoulders. And he'd always tell me, in unity, there's power. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous after being taken from the scrap heap. And I find out in here that in the unity of fellowship, there's a great power. And when I would show up at meetings and counting days, group of drunks, good early directions was my God, you guys. And I still need to be around you guys. But what has happened has been a transformation over the years going through this work where I found my own conception of a God, a loving and caring God that expresses himself through you over and over and over again. When I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, excuse me, 1988, if I live to be 100, I'll never be as old as they showed up in here. But something happened to me because of you. And I would rely on you. I'd go to meeting to meeting to meeting. Always thinking about a drink, but I'd show up at meeting to meeting to meeting. and you guys would try to give me some information. I found support here, but something else had to be done. And I knew that somewhere along the line, God was going to restore me to sanity. How? I made decision three and took action 4 through 9. I was in a meeting in Forest Hills not too long ago. And this girl, after I got done giving a talk, she came up to me. She says, I'm working the steps. And my sponsor told me to work the slogans, let go, let God. I said, well, what does that mean? Where are you? She says, well, I'm on page 89, but I'm doing my fourth step. I said, okay, I'm getting scared as she's talking now. Let go, let God. You're on page 89. You're doing your fourth step. And I asked her a question. In fact, I was corresponding some email with a friend about this. What does it mean to her to let go and let God? And she didn't have an answer for me. That's pretty frightening. Oftentimes we hear slogans being thrown, let go, let God, turn it over. When I was first coming around to her, turn it over, people meant well. I was so angry I wanted to turn tables over, turn the coffee pot over. What do you mean? How do I turn it over? What is this about? What are you talking about? Wonderful words, but if I don't have any kind of instructions on how to do them, they're just words to me. And I try to share with this woman on what it meant for me to turn it over and let go and let God. And as if somebody turned the light switch on for her. And I think she considered getting maybe a new sponsor. I don't know if I ruined that relationship or not. This last time around, I've gone through the work again. And without getting off topic here, I was one of those guys for a long time who admired people who went through the work over and over again. But I didn't think I need to, living in 10, 11, and 12. And I had legitimate reasons to believe that. But I hit a place here where a book talks about reemergence of ego. I've heard this. People talk about reemergence of ego. And I start to experience some spots in my life that I wasn't too happy about, that unmanageability. What I started to do was fully define and comprehend my God. My God is this, and I put him in a box. And once I started to do that, my life had to become unmanageable in certain areas, and eventually my entire life. And why? Because I was back in self again. If I'm in self, I'm in fear. My life has to be unmanageable. I was putting God in a box, which meant any new ideas I came across about God, I had to defend mine. I couldn't be completely open-minded and listen. I had to protect my God now. I was defining and comprehending my God. That became too painful. Little by slowly, by doing that, I noticed I was moved into managing my own life again. Because God is this, and I'm over here. So I have to manage my finances. I have to manage my relationship with my wife. I have to manage my relationships at work, across the board. I have to manage my sex life. Trouble, serious trouble. And it was starting to show up, little unmanageability. And I didn't see that until I went to this work again and I saw some of this stuff. That I was repeating some of the old mistakes over and over again, expecting different results. I will take care of it. So I feel very blessed that I was moved to a place to go through this work again and even do multiple fifth steps, which was a complete freedom. I was scared to death. But God moved me through this in my desire to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I remember after doing my second fifth step with my current sponsor, I was up at a big book meeting in Harlem. It was a few weeks later after doing this, and I sat in this living room in this workshop, and except what I would cause harm to others and maybe reveal things in poor taste, I was ready to share my life with the entire room, and that was freedom. As I am tonight, that's complete freedom. As long as it doesn't affect anyone in a negative way, that I wouldn't do. But I'm willing to share my entire life right here, right now, and that's a great freedom. I was not experiencing that right before I went into this work again. See, God will get me free every time. And for this, I'm very grateful. I'll close with this. The severed relationships I experienced, starting with my family, have been made good again. Before I got into my seventh rehab, I remember my dad, who I hadn't seen for quite some time, was gambling. He was in Atlantic City. And this one particular day, I had it. I knew I was going to die. And I begged to this loving God to save me, take me from this scrap heap. And my God didn't turn around and say, Peter, you made 6 rehabs. You've cursed me. You've burned every bridge I put in front of you. I'm through with you. I remember going to the phone and trying to call my dad a few times, collect, and I just couldn't do it. And he had this feeling in his gut that I was in trouble. And he showed up. And he found me over in Brooklyn. And I remember when he got out of the car, He just walked over to me, and I remember telling him, "Dad, I'm okay." And I had soiled clothes on. I hadn't bathed in quite some time. I was living the life of a dying drunk, if you will. And I remember falling into his arms and him holding on to me and telling me I was going to be okay. And I was in my seventh, and God willing, last rehab. That relationship has grown since I've been walking this walk. I heard somebody say about a year ago, "What you're doing speaks so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying." Many, many times I've told my dad and my family, "I'm going to do it this time. I'm doing good." I lasted 10 minutes. What I've been moved to do here is just live this life. The spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. Live this life. And those words, those actions are much more convincing than any words I can come up with. And when I do speak, the words become credible. These are some of the miracles I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous. My family's been reassembled. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. Some months are tougher than others, but I am. And I'll close with what I opened up with. Because of what I've been given here by you and this loving, infinite, merciful God, I stand here tonight not only sober and free, but I stand here with dignity tonight. I used to want to puke at what looked back in the mirror. I hated what looked back in the mirror. Today I don't. I just stand here with dignity, and that is a great freedom. My spirit has been awakened. I go home tonight and I don't have to worry about my behavior today, and I'll hit the pillow next to a woman that I really care about, that I adore. My cats will jump up on a bed, and it's my life, because Alcoholics Anonymous is my life, and I'm really okay with that. Thank you for listening.